This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The iconic PBS program, Firing Line with William F. Buckley, ran from 1966 to 1999. The show was known as a platform for debate and discussion for everything from politics to philosophical issues with all the experts. With over 1,000 programs in the archive at the Hoover Institution, it has quite the legacy. 20 years later, political commentator and analyst Margaret Hoover leads the new reprisal. Firing Line with Margaret Hoover maintains the character of the original show, featuring guests from the left and right sides of debates to have a rigorous and civil exchange of ideas. Margaret Hoover was in Milwaukee last month for a Milwaukee PBS event, and she took some time to speak with me on site. Hoover begins by explaining what excited her the most about taking part in leading the new Firing Line.
Many people don't realize it was the longest running television program in television history with a single host. It lasted even longer than Johnny Carson. So I was, as a young person growing up, aware of Buckley, aware of Firing Line. My parents watched it from time to time. But I was, you know, sadly young enough that I wasn't part of the conservative movement that came up through William F. Buckley's direct fingerprints. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have a personal relationship. I didn't know William F. Buckley. I've met his son since then and find him delightful, and I'm very grateful for his support for the program. But I didn't, you know, I didn't know Buckley. But I've come to know him, I feel, very intimately, because I have gone through scores, hundreds of his old programs. There are 1,504 episodes of Firing Line, and they are all archived at the Hoover Institution, which is a public policy think tank founded by Herbert Hoover, my great-grandfather, at Stanford University. So just watching these old programs, I've gotten such a great sense of Buckley and his wit and his affect and his sense of humor and his quick-mindedness. I mean, this was the thing that even he gave himself credit for. If he was nothing else, he was quick. He was very, very quick on his feet. And so I've gotten, I feel like I've really gotten to know him in a way, but you know, we're our own show. We're different. I'm not Buckley. I'm not trying to be Buckley. I have no interest in being Buckley. Nobody can be Buckley. I think many people have discovered that nobody can be Buckley. And what we are trying to do is riff from something that he bequeathed us, which is a long-form exchange of ideas where you can really dive deep into issues of the day that are important to public policy and important to all our lives. And it's sort of amazing that television and news and media have become so fast, and the news cycle has become so crowded that news consumption is crammed full of things that often are just skin deep. And so what I found in the sort of resurrection of Firing Line is that what's old is new again. You know, there was a kernel of wisdom in what Buckley was doing that we've kind of forgotten. And it's just take a moment to have a long-form exchange of ideas, by the way, with people that we don't always agree with. Because that contest of ideas provides for a far more rich and nuanced approach to issues. And by the way, I think that's what we recognize, especially at a national level, we're all deeply missing.
What are your biggest influencers or inspirations of hosts from different programs that you look to for inspiration, for ideas? Who did you research when you were looking into playing this host role?
I researched Buckley a lot because nobody's really done this. Only Buckley's done this. But I just think you have to be yourself, right? I don't think you can pretend to be anybody else or study anybody else or try to riff from anybody else. I think you just have to. So I can't say there's particularly one person that I look to in terms of their performance ability. I just think it's the kind of thing that the only way to learn to ride a bike is to start riding a bike.
What have you found to be pleasantly surprising in this new role for yourself with this new challenge of being a host?
I mean, what I've found is, shockingly, there's nothing else like this on television, even still. And the audience has really responded. I mean, people like being able to hear, see different people and engage in what is a respectful exchange of ideas. I think that people are very thirsty for content. I think people are thirsty for smart conversation. I think people are thirsty for a well-researched approach to issues. People who are interested in a pragmatic approach to solving problems. So, I mean, that was the thesis. That was our central thesis. But it's been proved correct.
What topics intrigue you the most? Do you also embrace the challenge of interviewing someone about a topic that you're not super familiar with, it's pretty impossible to be an expert on everything of every guest that you're going to talk to. So what's some of the things that you've found the most refreshing to research and to look into?
It's truly driven by what's interesting to me and what I think is relevant. I mean, I have been, just to give you a small example, you know, I have been deeply concerned about election security going into 2020, and deeply concerned that in the context of our current debates, and I don't mean just this impeachment inquiry, but I mean even against the backdrop of the Mueller report, I mean even truly since the 2016 election, it has been abundantly clear that we were completely sideswiped. We had no idea this was coming, although in hindsight, it turns out that the previous administration did know some and, you know, had to grapple with difficult and nuanced considerations about how much to share with the American public. I think in hindsight, they probably should have shared more. So this needs to be talked about. And I've been frustrated for such a long time that we haven't talked about it. We finally did a really good election security program with Mark Warner, who we had done a previous one. We had Angus King, who is an independent senator from Maine, on the Senate Intelligence Committee right around the time the Mueller report came out. But we also finally sat down with Mark Warner, who's a senior senator from Virginia, former governor of Virginia, and co-chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, along with Republican Richard Byrd. And we're able to really do a deep dive into what are our true vulnerabilities still on the industry side, on the legislative side, and from the executive branch. And by the way, from the Defense Department, because that's actually a big part of our cyber, our ability to be proactive through cyber defenses, is actually going to end up being a really big part of 2020 and securing our infrastructure in 2020. So impeachment inquiries are really important when they only come around, three times in the history of a representative democracy. On the other hand, the real challenge about ensuring that the result of 2020 is fair and accurate is ongoing.
So one thing that I think can be a real hindrance for people wanting to know more about these topics is they're complicated, right? And if they're only getting a surface level headline or a quick 5-minute newscast or something, they don't often know where to start to dive deeper. So when you're preparing your questions for your guests, how are you coming at that? Are you thinking of this person sitting on the couch watching your program?
1,000%. I mean, every interview is constructed in the way of a story. Is how we think about it. And I start by trying to understand and introduce the guest to the audience in a personal way so they know what their credentials are and why they're sitting down in front of us and why they have reason to be sitting down and diving into whatever issue it is. And frankly, I like to connect with people. Like, I'm interested in people and who they are and what motivates them and why they're sitting in front of me doing what they're doing and what's gotten them to the point. So I've done a lot of research into them personally and try to find ways of you know, there's always something you like about people. And so I try to find the things that I like and that we can connect about and try to evoke that. So, because then I feel a personal connection to them, but that comes through on camera. The audience does too. And then we try to tell a story about the issue. I mean, there's always, you know, for me, 3 or 4 things that I want answered or I want to get out of it or I want to see if the guest will play with. And that's sort of where I'm going. There's an arc to the conversation. And hopefully that makes the issues less menacing and more enjoyable.
With the original firing line, a big point of it was, quote, a balanced exchange of opinion, you know, and the media landscape is ever more combative and the spirit of respectful debate and of public discourse is not what it once was. How do you think we can regain these skills as Americans?
Look, I think actually Americans have it. I think we don't in the media. I think we don't in Congress. I think we don't in parts of the academy. What I am deeply concerned about is that we've created this, you know, there is a hyperpolarization in our politics and in our media that is actually doing us an enormous disservice. It's actually tearing us further apart. And by the way, the Russians are leveraging natural wedges in our society, and they're playing on them. I mean, we saw that in the Senate Intelligence Report that came out 2 weeks ago that demonstrated that the kneeling in the football team in the before the Pledge of Allegiance and the Star Spangled Banner at NFL games actually was amped up 10 times by Russian bots. This may not have even been a social issue that could have torn us apart on our respective cable news channels if we hadn't been so vulnerable to social media disinformation campaigns by foreign actors. So I think we've also created, frankly, a cycle of partisan media that is perpetuated by the profit margin. And we've also have the thing that Paul Ryan called the conservative industrial complex. There's one on the progressive side too, a progressive industrial complex. In other words, people who are invested and whose livelihoods are invested in continuing to make money on the polarization of our politics. And I think those two things combined, the partisan media combined with the partisan politics, perpetuates the sort of tearing apart of our civic discourse. And that's why what we do at Firing Line can only be on PBS in a way. I mean, we're privately funded. We don't have to race to the next break for a commercial. We can take the time to let an interview breathe, a set of ideas breathe. I have time to ask a follow-up question and then another follow-up question and then the follow-up to that follow-up. And so you get a really good sense of people and their ideas and what the issues are, whether it's Medicare for All or 2020 election security or gun control, right? We have the ability to do that, and the profit model hasn't demonstrated, although I think it'd be highly profitable. PBS has created a space for us to do that, and that's why I'm so grateful.
How does it feel for you to be part of, quote, the media that is often vilified and targeted these days for doing their work?
You know, it's interesting. The only reason I pause is because until this point in my life, I'd never considered myself a journalist. I haven't been. I'd been a commentator. I'd been an analyst. Even though I'd been on camera, I was never responsible for sort of unfolding the truth or trying to get at the truth with a guest. Mm-hmm. And it is more of a responsibility, and I take it really seriously. And look, the media is in the Constitution. The press is in the Constitution, protected in the First Amendment. And the attacks, mostly against the media, are coming from the right. And I have a very difficult time with the right, which has, at least for the time that I had been active in politics, working in Republican politics in the House of Representatives and in the executive branch in Washington, D.C., always being very quick to wrap its arms around the American flag and the Constitution. Suddenly having a problem with the First Amendment or blaming the media for the problems that its party has come into. It doesn't sit well with me. And I think, again, it points to the problem that I mentioned earlier, which is this problem of partisan, hyper-polarized, hyper-partisan media is not serving our country well.
What are your goals in what you do with this program in trying to help shift that in what way you can?
Look, I mean, I think we're new. This is just the beginning of our second season, or we're approaching halfway through our second season. But I think the goal for the program is to continue to grow, to grow our audience. And one of the challenges we find now, and bless Milwaukee airs us at 7:30 on Fridays, and we're very, very grateful. And we have a pretty robust following here in Milwaukee, which we're very happy about. But we want 100 Milwaukees. And, you know, so people can know where to find us and know how to tune in and can find us on all these multiple channels. So we're just really, we're growing, right? We've started, we have a great product, and we want to get the word out so we can engage more and more minds.
Now, I'd be remiss as a history nerd not to ask you about your family.
I love talking about Herbert Hoover more than almost anything.
Okay, great.
Maybe
great.
Even more than my small children.
Okay, so first random question. Do you have something of your great-grandfather's that is like just that you're really possessive of or is in your house or that is some sort of family heirloom?
I have a couple of things of his. I have my great-grandmother's copy of his book, American Individualism, which was the title I used for my book, American Individualism, which I published 10 years ago. I stand by every word I wrote, even though it's completely obsolete now. It was about how to not lose the millennials for the Republican Party. So, okay, that's fine. Maybe we lost that battle. But actually, that book, which my great-grandfather wrote, it was a sort of a treatise on what he viewed was special and unique about the American system. He was an orphaned boy, son of a blacksmith and a Quaker minister from Eastern Iowa, of little to no means, and was entirely self-made. And at the time that he turned 40, he was living in London, which was the capital of mining finance. He was a self-made mining engineer, and he ended up in a position where he could organize the first international humanitarian food campaign to save an entire nation from starvation during World War I, which was the nation of Belgium. And he single-handedly created this entity, which became the template for humanitarian food relief operations. It became the template for UNICEF. Literally, Maurice Pate, whose work won UNICEF the Nobel Peace Prize in 1965, had worked for Herbert Hoover when he orchestrated Belgian food relief during World War I. So I get very, very excited about Herbert Hoover's legacy and the book he wrote right at the time. He was returning from Europe after feeding the Europeans after World War I. He wrote this book, American Individualism, which crystallized his philosophy for frankly, why his story was possible. An orphan boy from a frontier town in America could rise to the levels of engineering success, commercial success that he had experienced and wealth at that time. But also to be able to be in a position where he could make a huge difference in the lives of millions of people and be on a prominent actor on the world stage at the signing of the Treaty of Versailles at the end of World War I. I mean, and so that book, that pamphlet was called American Individualism, and it was really, it was sort of like a, I mean, it was his testament to the values and the functions that make America possible and his story possible. And my great-grandmother's copy of American Individualism, which she kept with her, I have at home, and it's a deeply meaningful piece to me. I also have my parents, when I had published the book American Individualism, took my great-grandfather actually wrote 38 books. he was prolific. And his very first book contract they framed for me and gave me. So his book was called Principles of Mining. It was published in 1919, and it's still in print. This is like an extraordinary thing. So there are a lot of small mementos that are very meaningful. And frankly, it's just I'm so energized by Hoover's example, because he truly is this person. Even it was the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, he was a technologist, he was a person of the world, he was a problem solver, and he was a servant, a civil servant. And his example is an example, I think, that's so tangible right now.
Have you always been energized by your family's legacy, or have you had differing relationships with it as you've aged and learned more?
I always knew the side of Herbert Hoover that I'm espousing right now, but I also always knew the side that, like, most of my friends thought it was, like, something I should be embarrassed by, because there is, of course, this, you know, pejorative of Herbert Hoover's association with the Great Depression. And many of my friends and my friends' parents growing up just thought, oh, isn't that a shame? You know, isn't that a shame she's related to Herbert Hoover? And, you know, I think, you know, of course, as we've learned more about modern macroeconomics, I think people understand that Hoover wasn't to blame for the Depression, that it happened 6 months after he was he became president, but that also, and certainly he made mistakes handling the Great Depression, but I think the Fed made much more mistakes, and that's quantifiable now. I think, you know, economists understand that, mainstream historians are beginning to understand that, and with that new understanding, I think a new look at Hoover's legacy is in order.
With being a part of the Hoover family legacy, you mentioned his first book really instilled part of the way you view things. Are there any other family lessons that are instilled in you that have been passed down to generations that you in turn pass on to yours?
What I'd say is I think there's something about values. And Herbert Hoover was a Quaker. He was the first Quaker president. And, you know, my family is actually Episcopalian. Lew Henry Hoover was Episcopalian. Herbert Hoover was Quaker. Although he stopped going to Quaker meeting when he was Commerce Secretary because too many people at meeting in Washington, D.C. would be moved by the spirit to preach against his policies. So he really just, he was an avid fisherman, and I think that was his time with God. Sure. But, you know, a real reverence for public service, and public service in its most, I think, honest formulation, which is that you're there truly offering your services to the public. And, you know, I think there's a pragmatic problem solver that Hoover's example also yields and lends. And there's a real reverence for our institutions and reverence for the country and reverence for our founding documents and respect for the trust and faith that the American people put into office holders and real concern not to abuse that. So I think all of those values I grew up with, because even though I never knew Herbert Hoover, he died in 1916, 64 and I was born in 77, so I missed him by 13 years. My dad was very close to him. My dad lived with him in the Waldorf Astoria for his last 20 years of his life in his post-presidency. He lived there, and my dad lived close by and lived with him even for a year as a small boy. So my dad and he had a very sweet relationship, and he knew him well, and I've gotten to know many people who knew him well. And I have been instilled with a real sense of his honor and his dignity and his kindness and how revered he was to the people who knew him very well. And then, and how much he cared about this country and our principles, and it really does get handed down. So I feel very blessed to have been exposed to a small, sort of interesting slice of American history, and I'm very proud of Herbert Hoover, and I'm very passionate, as you can see, about ensuring that his legacy is appropriately honored in history.
Margaret Hoover is the host of Firing Line with Margaret Hoover on PBS. She spoke with us while she was in town for an event at Milwaukee PBS, and you can find out more at wuwm.com.